So it is really great to be with you all today, and I hope it's stimulating for all of us to be doing this work. Has everyone got the little outline that is available, I think, so that can be brought in? But I've got a couple of opening exercises I want to start with. So the first one is more just kind of us to limber up. So I'd just love you to write down, and this is to write down an observation, a question, and a suggestion for mission and ministry in our current cultural context. You might only get to one or two of those, but so thinking about our current cultural context, which is what we want to think about today, the situation in which we are proclaiming the name of Jesus and planting churches and preaching the gospel, what's an observation you've got, something that you notice, you just think, oh, I notice that this is true of our context. Maybe it's become true in the last 5 years, maybe it's been true for the last 50 years, but just an observation that you want to say, I notice that in our context, X. Does that one make sense? A question to think, oh, I wonder this about our context. So why is everyone angry about that? Or why does no one understand this? Or why is a thing that used to get responded to this way getting responded to that way? So a question about our cultural context. And finally, a suggestion to say, hey, we found this really helpful. Or I think this has really advanced us in doing ministry in our context. Do those questions make sense? So that's a little kind of 3 to 5 minute settle and get your head into where we're going today. All right, and we might get you to, for my benefit, if you can, when you give your first input into today, if you say your name and maybe where you serve, that would be lovely here. So let's go. So what have you got in terms of observations about our the context in which we serve the Lord? Yeah.
And that Christians, evangelical Christians, are regarded not only as different but dangerous.
Right, yes. Christians, and particularly evangelical Christians, are regarded as different but dangerous. Yes. And you're saying that's true of our context. Like that's perhaps not always true in all times and places.
Okay, it's increasingly so.
Yep.
In the way that the society is more militant in its promotion of it in general.
Yes, yep. Yep, thank you. That's absolutely. Other observations? Yes.
I'm a champion.
Hang on.
New Age stuff seems to disappear.
Yeah, really interesting observation, and it's one of the, I reckon one of the warnings against thinking that history moves in a linear fashion is that I think in the, what would you say, early 1990s, you might have thought, oh, we better put a lot of time and energy into New Age, because this seems to be sweeping up a lot of the space that's been left by the churches, and now, you know, I was trying to think last night, I used to think of Fremantle as a very New Age area of Perth. I can't think of a crystal shop. I think they've all closed. You know what I mean? It seems to have gone. So, right. So, yeah, you think it's hard for churches. Imagine being New Age. But, yeah, there's an observation. Yes? Great. An active aim of reducing Christian influence?
It's not just, let's ignore Christianity, but let's actually work, you know, to reduce its influence. So
yeah.
Through, you know, the way the same school of education, whatever, just, you know, yeah, they don't ignore us. They actually, you know, work systematically and deliberately.
Yes. Yes, yeah. Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
And I don't think that was around, you know, at all.
No, yeah, that does feel new. It does feel like at least a new species of whatever generic hostility to God is. That feels like a new one. Yes.
The same people who might have argued for a kind of relativism in the 90s are now arguing for absolutism in terms of science and things like that.
Yeah, I reckon that's, so you have the observation of the decrease of the space occupied by the New Age, and then that increase, I remember at university in the 90s, I was there in the early 1990s, and you felt like one of the cards you could always play was, well, one of the cards that was often played was that, oh, but nothing's absolute, everything's relative, I would never want to... And I think even the... tell me if you think this is right. I feel like at university, the, for example, the LGBT agenda, which was there in the early 1990s, was somewhat curtailed by the thought that Indigenous culture and traditional culture didn't think like that about sexuality. So the idea that, you know, if you were playing your cards and someone said, oh, I think we should be much more, liberated in our sexuality and they should be more prominent on campus. Someone said, oh, what about our Muslim friends or, Indigenous friends? Then that would be like, oh yeah, don't want to offend them. Whereas now it feels like, well, they've got to learn. Like, this is true as opposed to false, not my truth. It's kind of a truth that needs to be rolled out. That wasn't the example you used, but you're talking about and I think New Atheism is probably like that as well. They're not modestly putting forward a tentative, self-fulfilling narrative.
So things like, vaccination.
Yes.
So with, like, the idea that you say, oh, maybe it's not true or fake news or something like that. That we're horrible.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, the anti-vaxxers and stuff, that's a, yeah, great illustration of that observation. Yeah. Couple of other ones?
Yeah.
Christine. It's everywhere, right. Yes, as the kind of... Yes, yeah. Does it describe more than us, or it's mainly us? Yeah. Yes. Yeah, bigoted... Yeah, bigot. Yeah, I think that's true. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I feel like it's not just us, though, Rory. Jonathan from Money Valley, that if I disagree with someone's idea, I must hate their person, and therefore... I can be described as a bigot. A very quick switch from playing the idea to playing the person.
Yes. Yeah. What do you think that comes from? Or where do you see it?
I see it in the discussion around, say, homosexual practice. To disagree with the idea of marriage equality,
yep,
is to hate the people that want it,
yep,
and to therefore be narrow-minded.
Yes. Yeah.
So it's almost like my idea gets shut down because I don't want to be a person that is seen to be hating others. So I think it's a strategy that causes me to question my idea.
Yes. Yes. And it's a way of de-platforming people, which again wasn't a thing in the 90s.
Yeah.
Like, in principle, deplatforming someone was wrong in the 90s. How could you ever deny someone a voice? Well, now, all the time, you can't speak here, Richard Dawkins can't speak there, you can't, that opinion's not even allowed to be in the discussion. Yeah. One of the campaigners for the eventually highly successful yes vote for same-sex marriage in Ireland, in the Republic, it was interviewed on Radio National a few months ago, and he said the problem was that the opposers put forward arguments. He said, we didn't put forward a single argument. We just told stories. And he said they made a huge mistake because they put forward a cogent argument about how rational and coherent the idea was. He said, we just told stories about your sister and your cousin and your uncle and how lovely they are, and they just kind of totally miss each other on the identity politics versus the, can we have this discussion? Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
I'm Sarah from the U. I don't know if this is more so now than it has been, but I feel like, certainly in my childhood, there was a sort of fear of God, even from people that weren't in the course of the
U. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Yep. Yep. Great observation. That fear of God, that kind of basic, very low level piety of, but I wouldn't want to disown this institution or this thing or that. Yeah, that's right. I think also, Matt, I wonder whether it's, we're doing a thing on guidance in a few weeks at our church. And I feel like one of the things growing up was that guidance was a hot topic because I want to do God's will and what if I miss it? I think included in any teaching on guidance now is a bunch of Christian people who kind of sort of don't really care whether they're living in the will of God. Just that basic kind of what if I miss God's will, that autonomous individual is so prominent that it's not as hot a topic, slash you have to persuade people that it kind of matters that you are in God's will, whatever that looks like.
Yeah.
Let's go one more observation, then we'll move on to questions and yes. Okay, great. So we're moving into questions. Why is it not? Paul says he's not ashamed of the gospel. We're in a situation where there's a certain amount of fear, shame, whatever. Why not just? Is not the obvious answer? We could be over by 10. Because what's there to say? Just don't be ashamed and proclaim. Great, good question. Other questions in this space? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, great example. So, in some ways, probably the least violent culture, maybe in history, in terms of our aversion to violence, coupled with perhaps the most violent culture in history in terms of our fiction. So, Game of Thrones makes the Odyssey look tame, and it takes a lot to make the Odyssey look tame. The Odyssey, the Iliad, is not a tame book. So incredibly violent fiction with a very pacifist culture that also aborts 100,000 babies a year. Yeah, how's that work? Yeah, and babies seem almost the paradigm case of the vulnerable. And you'd feel like, how can you not say, hey, you know how you think that asylum seekers are vulnerable, which I also think they're vulnerable, also babies, and that just you cannot get that traction. Yeah.
They're not avoiding babies, they're avoiding clusters.
Right, yes, yeah, yeah. So the way the argument works, that's right, is that the thing you're avoiding is not a baby. Well, it's so... Yes, yeah. There is some statistically significant evidence that the younger you go, that we've reached peak abortion, not in terms of the amount, but in terms of the plausibility of that argument, that the quality of ultrasounds has meant that argument's had to change a bit. Yeah. No, sorry. Yes, so that's another good micro example of maybe also a macro point. Another micro point, there's another kind of seemingly incoherent thing that we're like, science, and I think to an extent that is quite distinctive, the way in which evolution is drawn on, not just as a biological account of our origins, but as a creation myth for our ethics. That evolution has become that kind of just-so story that explains everything. And yet, you would think, surely that as a just-so story is hugely pro-reproduction and whereas actually, no, those two big issues are kind of antithetical to, Yeah, great observation. Any more questions, or maybe we go into a couple of suggestions? Yes.
I've got a question before we go to suggestions. Peter Rose, St. Stephen's Tambo.
Hi.
How might the Australian Church present a united voice to the nation about the love of Christ and what flows from that?
Beautiful question. How might the Australian Church present a united voice to the nation? Beautiful. Yeah. Well, if you're going to underline or italicise one of those words, or...
About the love of Christ.
Yes, okay. Yep. Yep. Cool. The united thing, is that...
Yeah.
Do you feel like there's a disunity?
I don't see any voice, really.
Yeah, okay.
A voice of the Christian Church.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Got it. Thank you. Yeah. Other questions or suggestions? I mean, that's kind of a suggestion as well. Yes.
Epic matter seeks more than apologetics, but apologetics doesn't cease happening. It's just an aspect of your second
world. Right. Ethics matters more than apologetics.
Sorry, this is my suggestion.
Yes.
In my conversation.
Do you mean by that that the question "Does God exist?" is less prominent to the question "How can you possibly believe that there's a prohibition on any kind of consensual sex?" So they're two intellectual conundrums, or do you mean the way Christians commend the gospel with an ethically lived life?
I don't know.
Both those things. Yeah. That's good. Excellent. Well, let's. Someone's got. Nope. Well, okay. Let's go. Here we go. Jesus after religion, ministry in the secular space. It's what we want to think about, now. I have a series of premises I want to put forward, each of which are contestable, and I want us to think in the time that we have together and for a tiny bit of this afternoon, about the kind of the history and shape of secularization and secularism. So secularization, the process of a society becoming secular, and secularism, the mental furniture and lived lives of a secularized society. And want us to think together about what faithful Christian gospel-driven ministry would look like in a world like that. And today we'll be driven somewhat historically by trying to think about how secularization happened, and then intellectually by what secularism looks like and feels like, and then finally thinking about faithful Christian responses. And when we're looking at Christian responses, I didn't want to put up any straw men, like here's a crazy response that no one would do, but to say within the kind of realm of biblically faithful Christian responses, what can we learn and how can we think about our work. I want to give you those premises, but I've got one more very quick exercise that I think will help us, that I'd love you to do somewhere on your sheet, or if you've got another, or on, I think there's some spare pages there. So thinking about secularization, that's a social process, I want you to do a little timeline of your understanding of how that process has happened. So if you were explaining to someone, say it was kind of, you walked in here, you didn't realise it was an exam on secularisation, and the question was, draw a timeline of the process of secularisation in the West, what does your timeline look like? So there might be people, events, places, dates. You won't get examined on this or whatever, so don't get nervous. But I'd love you to try that, because I think that'll really limber us up for jumping straight in. So, 3 minutes, your kind of biblical theology, your timeline, your history of secularization, in the West. Your time starts now. That's it. Pens down, people. Okay. Let's see what's in our head. So what, if you were trying to tell the story of secularisation, give the history, the kind of key moments and stuff like that, what do you want to get up there? What have you got on your chart? Yes?
If you go right back to the Reformation, Enlightenment, and then the
Okay, so let's, so the furthest, does anyone want to outbid that? So,
early church.
Early church, okay.
Secular, you're in secular world.
Yeah, okay, so we've got a...
fall in Genesis 3.
Okay, let's say Bertha's church. Say Bertha's church, and then we'll say you are here. That's our timeline. So if we're kind of thinking there, then maybe we'll run out of space. But so you want to put the Reformation in there?
Yeah, I put the breakaway from the institutional church and putting interpretation onto the individual, then kind of set the path to enlightenment where rationality can be decided by the individual, to postmodernism where it doesn't really matter so much. It's just how you feel on the individual level. In my general broad strokes.
Okay. So you're thinking there's Reformation introduces a degree of, like, some sort of accidental autonomy. Like, I don't think that's what Calvin didn't get out of bed and think, how do I create that? But, okay, so there could be Reformation could be introducing an autonomy.
Descartes.
Where, sorry, well.
Descartes.
Yeah, Descartes is here. And what do you think Descartes? Does? Yeah, okay, so the turn, they call it the turn to the subject. So Descartes, remember, goes out to a shack by himself, and his agenda is to think to himself, where is a proper foundation for knowledge and thought and ethics? And he thinks, he goes by process of doubt and thinks, how much could you doubt? He thinks, could I doubt that I'm in this cavern? Yeah, I can doubt that. Could I doubt that I'm a Christian? Yeah. Could I doubt God? Yeah. Could I doubt anything? Could I even doubt that this whole thing is real? That absolutely nothing here is real? You could even doubt that, because there could be a matrix thing, or as he says, there could be a demon who's planting this stuff in my head. But I can't doubt that I am doubting. I'm thinking. And even if I'm thinking a whole lot of stuff that isn't true, I'm thinking. And so he says, he hit bedrock and he found something. And then from the process of discovering, I think, therefore I am, then we can rebuild. And next minute, he's a kind of Roman Catholic again. And so he goes all the way down there. But, so the philosophical theory goes, what's the right metaphor? The method led to the conclusion. So even though he ended up being a fully functional Roman Catholic again, the path by which you get there set a whole path that was perhaps changed the way we think and do things. Other key dates?
Because the Middle Ages order of thinking, where you've got God, church, state, individual.
Yep.
We're going to reverse that somewhat. Well, state's going to take that. From a political viewpoint, the state's going to take that.
And then in somewhere in the
So here,
the Enlightenment, and maybe the state replaces God, and then finally, yes, yep.
With the rise of democracy, the state cedes power to the people, so the people become the state rather than the state.
Yes. So you have what Charles Taylor would say, there's this whole period of reform. Which he uses a big R for reform, and he means not just the Reformation, but you're having that, the democratic reforms. And, sorry, you're now saying that democracy, the rise of modern nation-state democracy, brings what?
So we believe we are the state, rather
than... Right, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the state's not given by God, the divine right of kings, but we the people. Yeah.
Excellent. I was going to add to the Enlightenment bit, it's kind of where deism emerges, so this idea of a distinct God. So it means that it's kind of a bit of a time bomb set off, kind of the way that God is no longer imminent.
Yes.
It makes a difference to the way people think day to day. And I was just going to say, a bit different to the sexual revolution in the 70s, probably at the corny end of that scale, has shaped our sexualization, like the culture that.
Yes. Okay, so we're going to, two things here. We're going to say that deism may have influenced the way we think about God, and then people would argue that a lot of our apologetics came out of a shadow boxing with a God that's not the Bible God with predictable results. And then you're wanting to get the sexual revolution in here.
I don't know about this one, but what do you think about Nineveh, where faith is put in the public sphere, although not the Christian faith, and betrayed, obviously, quite poorly?
Yes.
I don't know. That's just my opinion.
Yeah, so 9/11 is interesting because it's up till September the 10th, you could say that religion's just an interesting narrative that kind of shapes lives in various ways and brings meaning and fulfillment to various individuals. Who am I to judge? Then September 12th, you're like, oh, someone else's meaning had a direct impact on my meaning. Yes, yeah, and I don't think if you were reading New Atheist material here and you didn't know about that, you'd think, what, how did this all start? And if someone tells you, actually, oh, a guy flew into a tower and absolutely said it was not to do with economics, or it wasn't to do with economics, it wasn't a cry of the poor, it was a wealthy young man who believed in jihad, and yeah, I think it's very worth doing that. Yes? And, oh, we'll go to there. Sorry, sir. Oh, yes, oh, well, go ahead.
I was just thinking about, is it the way from Rome?
Yep.
You know, that sort of marked, I think, the very, they said about rights.
Yes.
Individual rights.
Yep. Yep. Great. Wade versus Roe, the decision of the American Supreme Court in the 60s. I can't remember. Any American would be able to reel that date off straight away. But. Sorry, sir. And then.
I think the influence of Darwin.
Right, so is that 1857
The Origin?
Yes. So Origin of Species is published, and
The Origin of Species and the Struggle for Life and All Faith Progress.
So say that again? The Origin of Species?
The Origin of Species and the Struggle for Life and Faith Progress.
Right, there you go. A more prejudicial title. Well, a title that's less, yeah. And yes. Yes, okay. So the technology that makes it possible to be an individualist, and then what you also mentioned the war, was that
because...
Okay, so the... Yeah, right. There wouldn't have been a plane to fly into a tower, there wouldn't have been a tower to fly into. Yes. Yeah, that's right. Okay, yeah, so the earthquake of Lisbon takes years for that information to come through Europe. In some places, no, probably most Europeans, or, you know, whereas now that happens, and by September 11, 10 a.m, everyone knows what's going on. Yeah. Yes.
I heard an argument recently that the combustion engine and harnessing the electricity changed fundamentally us from a survival mode to have a capacity to pursue affluence.
Right.
Happiness. And so that kind of transformation, that we're not just living day to day, but actually we have the capacity, say, for mass production or eating, frees us up to then decide what is my purpose, because my purpose isn't survival anymore, so I've got that patience.
Wow.
That's a significant turning point.
Right.
Of social development.
So this is more, it's kind of more of a technology, so you're saying the engine?
Yeah,
right. And
industrial. So the argument was that, say, from 1850 to 1950, there was this huge change.
Yes.
In the combustion engine and electricity. But then from 1950, say, through now, we've still basically got cars and we've still got PowerPoints.
Yes.
We've just got smarter, safer, quicker.
Is that Tyler Cowen? The Great Stagnation?
It was someone else.
Okay. There's an argument from an economist called Tyler Cowen where he describes our era as the Great Stagnation.
Okay.
So odd. But his thought experiment is to say, he says that if you took someone from 1900 and brought them into a 1950s kitchen, it would be a different world. The bathroom is inside, the kitchen is electric, there's a zzz, zzz, and there's all this stuff. He said, if you take someone from 1950s to, the year 2000, said, not that much change. You have to explain how the microwave works. That's about it. And so he says that there's been this huge change with bits, but not a huge change with atoms. And so that digital world is suddenly off the charts, which, anyway, whereas like cars are slower now, the speed limit, comes in, the Concorde's gone, but there's all this stuff that's kind of, Yes, right. Yes. And the huge sexual, the huge pressure against sexual infidelity had this obvious real life implication that if the father leaves the family, which is 9 times out of 10 the problem that you're trying to solve, because fathers can leave families in a very different way to mothers, and so every culture everywhere has massive prohibitions against, has a way of keeping families together. But if you've got a situation where there's a welfare state, there's technology, then All right, let's go. Thank you. That's very, very helpful, and hopefully, I hope, stimulating, because that's the exact kind of space we're trying to occupy today. So this is how I propose we move through the rest of today. So I've got these three key premises that I want to run through the rest of the time that we have. So the three key premises are this. Firstly, that the religious landscape has changed dramatically in Australia in the last few decades. So that's my first premise. The religious landscape has changed dramatically in Australia in the last few decades. So not in a linear fashion, not in an easy evolutionary, but dramatically. My second premise is that the process can be broadly understood as secularisation, that what's happening broadly considered is secularisation, and that the changes are enough to require a rethink of some of our approaches to mission and ministry. So they're my three premises. Something has changed dramatically on the religious landscape in Australia. That process can be understood broadly as secularisation, and that thirdly, it does require a rethink of some of the ways we approach mission and ministry. Now, I think all three of those premises are true, but all three are hotly debated and debatable. So I want to put them forward not as we hold these truths to be self-evident, but premises to be held up to critical evaluation, things that we'll have to argue for rather than argue from. So I'll give you problems with all of them. So firstly, the religious landscape has changed dramatically in Australia in the last few decades. Is that true? What is true is that there has been a rise of pluralism through immigration and other ways, a much more plural society in terms of the belief options that are available. There has been a decline in both the relative and net place of Christianity in the religious landscape, so less Christians and less Christian influence. And there has been an increasing irrelevance of Christianity since the 1960s and an increasing hostility since the mid-2000s. So I'd say increasing irrelevance since the 60s and hostility since the 2000s. So to quote Simon Smart from the Centre of Public Christianity, he describes Australia now as a thin layer of hostility over a vast sea of apathy. Thin layer of hostility over a vast sea of apathy. And I think it's hard to argue with any of that, has the move, so this is where you could argue with that premise, has the move been from a Christian to a post-Christian nation? We once were Christian and became post-Christian. Now, there is a kind of vast literature that would say, no, because we never were Christian. that we haven't, you can't become post-Christian when you weren't ever Christian. Some people would argue that. Others, would argue that we're a long way off being anything as recognisably post-Christian in a broadly cultural sense. So for example, Edwin Judge, well, for the first one, I think that kind of mainstream of Australian historiography, like, Russell Ward and Manning Clark and so on, that kind of, maybe not so much Manning Clark, but, a kind of a radical downplay in the place of Christianity in the nation's history. Ancient historians like Edwin Judge would say that when we talk about Australia being post-Christian, we don't understand how deeply Christian even the secular person you sit next to is. And so he says, if you do the thought experiment of take the person next to you on the bus, take them back 2,000 years to ancient Rome, and get them to operate there, and they'll suddenly discover that they're quite Christian in a whole lot of assumptions about human rights, about the place of women, about views of, you know, there's just a whole lot of stuff that is, even if someone is not or anti-Christian, they are shaped by a kind of Christian, Christian and Western culture. So the first one is arguable. Some would, and then there's a big argument over whether that phrase "last few decades" is faithful, because you can people keep moving the needle back for where you say where does the thing that we now face have its origins, and you could argue that it's not in the last few decades. The second premise, that process can be broadly understood as secularisation. That's debatable. So there is a school of sociologists and historians who argue that secularisation is not happening. So there is a literature, we'll come to those arguments later, who just say, whatever this is, it's not called secularisation. And again, you could argue that whether that's a last few decades thing or not. And then thirdly, these changes require a rethinking of some of our approaches to mission and ministry. You could argue against that because some would argue that either the changes are not substantial enough to require a rethink, to say it's not that different from ministry in the 50s or the 30s or whatever, it's not that different, so no big rethink required, or that in principle Christians aren't in the business of rethinking what we do. So we should not rethink as a matter of principle, that would just be faithless to do that. And of course there are real threats there. In fact, I'm going to list some of the real threats. I think a few of the threats in the kind of thinking that we want to do today, there is the problem I think we face of the snake oil salesman. Because at least experientially things seem to have changed quite quickly and gone south quite quickly in a lot of ways, if you would like more people to know the Lord Jesus, then I think we are kind of sitting ducks for the kind of the guy selling the monorail to come through and say, you know, here's the kind of crazy solution to all our problems. And so that's a risk for us. The eternal nature of the gospel means that rethinking should at least make everyone in this room half pause and to say, hey, what exactly are you proposing we rethink? And in which direction do you want that rethinking to go? Rethinking can easily be lead toward unfaithfulness when you're rethinking the content of the gospel, or a distraction when you're just rethinking the kind of inconsequential furniture of, you know, whether church is at 10 or 10:30 or whatever. I think especially in this modern age, a few of us talked about the rate of communication and the internet and so on, we have what I call the thought leader problem, which is that there, in a way that has not been true in Christian history before, there's a whole ton of people who are writing blogs and books and so on about this stuff who themselves are not accountable to any Christian community. So there's been the rise of a thing called the thought leader, who is saying, hey Christians, we're in a very desperate situation, I've got some snake oil and I need to sell it to you, and it's easy to sell because we feel the desperation, and they're people that are held to no account in any Christian community, which is a very new thing. So you think about all the theologians that you know and love, like Augustine, pastor of a local church. Calvin, pastor of a local church. Wesley, leader of a mission. You know, it's a very new thing to have such a thing as a person who just blogs. I think that's kind of a dangerous thing. And then finally, the knowledge problem. So this is from Hayek, the economist, who just says that, you know what, society is kind of big and complex and weird, and you normally only find out 100 years later why that war happened in the first place. And the idea that any of us knows which lever to pull and how to pull it and what the consequences of pulling that lever would be, it's worth pausing and thinking more incrementally and conservatively about the kinds of changes we might countenance. Any questions or comments about that as a kind of broad thing? So if I didn't persuade you of any of those, that would be okay. If you think, not that big a change, there is a big change, but secularisation is the wrong word for it, or it has changed, it is secularisation, but I'm not changing anything, I'm open to all those pushbacks.
Just a comment about the blogger. Did you say Calvin is known because he survived? Publishers, writers, you know, back in the 90s we've got fringy people who are not, you know, who are writing stuff about church, who get their audience skills, which are maybe not widely published,
yeah,
but they still have a following. So which maybe is different.
Right. Yes, okay.
And I'll never stand up against the Calvin or that.
Yes, okay. So it might be that the historical record is prejudiced in favour of people that did actually do something substantial and everyone fell to the dust of history. Yeah, okay. Yeah. That might be true. I certainly do think anytime someone says to me, everything needs to radically change, the church used to do X, now it needs to do Y, I do want to know, do you lead a church that went from X to Y? And did you bear the? Are you just saying this from here, or are you in a community that has borne the costs of that change?
But if you're going to do that with writing the book in the nights, you're going to try and work out. You know, you pick up a book somewhere.
Yes.
It's been recommended. You get out, or say, who's the person who did that? You're trying to get into the somehow.
Yes. Yes. Okay. Yes. Yeah. That's fair. So maybe blogging or whatever aids and abets the volume of stuff that comes out, but such a thing, that was a question worth asking in the 1500s. Is this person accountable to a Christian community? Yeah. Great. Excellent. Okay. So they're the premises that I'm working with today, and here's my modest set of aims. I hope you walk away from today with a broad grasp of the field of secularisation, the study of secularisation, that you see some of its complexities. I think it'd be a really good outcome, if we went home today and thought, it's a bit more complicated than the story in my head and the story in the head of the person on the bus next to me. And so therefore to develop some appropriate scepticism, both to secular claims and to Christian solutions. So to be a little bit sceptical about the way, Richard Dawkins tells his story, or your favourite broadsheet newspaper tells his story, and to be a little bit sceptical about the person who says the problem is X, so if we do Y and pull lever Q, then A will result. I just don't think that's the case. And then to think together on some broad contours of a faithful response and to be hopefully collaborative in that. I think I understand from the census that this is the smartest city in Australia, is that right? So how foolish of me to come from one of the dumbest cities in Australia to Australia's smartest city and not learn from you. So I trust that as a room of people who yourselves are accountable to Christian communities and ministries, then we together can think about some responses. So I've got a now, where, how response. What's the situation now? Where should we be going and how could we get there? Just biographically, very quickly, so I'm from Albany and in Western Australia. Lived in Papua New Guinea for 2 years with my parents who were missionaries there, and then back to Perth and did my studies there. And I studied anthropology and English at uni, so an arts graduate, and particularly was interested in anthropology and sociology, and studied in Perth and Singapore, and loved that. And I've just recently finished a PhD on Donald Robinson, who is a Australian clergyman, went on to be the Archbishop of Sydney, but is more famous for his biblical studies than he is for his Christian leadership. And so, and I think it was probably between Growing up a bit in Papua New Guinea, studying anthropology at uni, and then studying this recent study on Donald Robinson, I think they're probably the kind of biographical things that have made this fascinating for me, as a topic. And particularly with Donald Robinson was born in 1922. He's still with us, in a retirement village and not well. And he studied in Cambridge from 1947 to 1950. And then he came back to Australia in 1950, taught in Sydney at Moore College, through the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s. He became a regional bishop in Parramatta and the Archbishop of Sydney, in 1981. And the way I wrote the thesis was chronologically, so I'd go kind of section by section, birth to Cambridge, time in Cambridge, first in and stuff like that. And you just felt the 60s coming. And when they came and they landed very heavily. And, Donald Robinson came back from Cambridge into what was to be a modest religious boom in Australia. So you get off the plane, and the 50s, things go up. And so if you were drawing a linear graph and expected history to go in a linear fashion, in 1951, you'd think, man, this thing's really going somewhere. And 1959, you'd think, oh man, this is game on. And suddenly, the tsunami of the 60s hit, and he is in a very different, situation. So it was really, that bit of research got me onto the historical thing about what happened then. What was that all about? Okay, that's it. I know we've been waggling over the tea for a long time. I'm going to show you a picture of a video shop in Albany. Can we have the video shop? This is my civic video in Albany. My parents live in Albany. They still live down there, so we have all our holidays in Albany with the kids, because it's for all the reasons that you could guess, it's a great thing to holiday with your parents / babysitters. And they live in Albany, so and they haven't got Netflix, and so when we go down there, we normally go to the DVD shop to buy DVDs. And I think the same thing every time I'm in there, which is kind of, what's the plan here? Like, what's the plan for this video shop? And I kind of do my imagining of what the quarterly vision casting meeting is like for civic video in Albany. And I've run this scenario in my head every time I go there to get DVDs. So theory one, maybe at the vision casting scenario, it's just kind of like just boundless optimism. Maybe they're just kind of blindly thinking, oh yeah, cool, DVDs, who could not love DVDs? And like, DVDs are the best, and how would this technology ever run out of steam? This is great, and maybe they're just kind of making plans. That's one possibility. I think the most tragic possibility Pacific video in Albany is not that they're just blindly optimistic, but that they're misreading the data. Because Albany used to have 10 or 11 DVD shops, and now it's got 3. But think about it for a moment. If you go from 11 to 3 in a very quick space of time, what happens to the 3 remaining DVD shops? Booming. And so if you could misread the data and get the staff team together and say, guys, I don't know what we're doing, but we are doing something right. Like, whatever, don't change a thing, this is happening. And you look at the graph and we are nailing it, we're doing very well. And then they could plan for expansion and start to think, let's redouble our investments in this thing, not realising that the very thing that means the graph is going up is the thing that inevitably means that graph will go down precipitously very soon. Huh. Or thirdly, I reckon they'd probably get it. But my guess is that it's civic video in Albany. They're not telling the kids, hey, kids, this is my inheritance to you. I want our family to be a generational DVD family. I don't think they're trying to buy up new places. I reckon they've got a plan and exit strategy, and they're going to go as far as they can. Which brings me to Christianity in Australia. It's entirely possible to get this stuff wrong. And I worry about all those things. Worry that we're just blindly optimistic. I do know, I'm pretty sure it's right, that our particular church, Providence Church in Perth, that a substantial bit of its growth recently has just been that there are less churches in Perth. Especially in our church, which has less, has a lot of young adults in it. 10 years ago, there were like, maybe a dozen evening congregations, you know, 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock congregations, that young people could go to, and they've almost all died. And I'm aware that, part of our growth can't be, oh, whatever we're doing something right, and everyone should copy this. It's just, it's a sign of a more depressing, picture, in Perth. Tim Adney, I don't know if you've got this on your thing, a friend of mine who writes, he says, every action in the present embeds a hypothesis about the future. Everything you do in the present embeds a hypothesis about the future. So you think about Civic Video in Albany. Whatever they're doing now is, whatever decisions they make will be shaping their view of what's coming. And I think that's just true. It's got to be true. And so I think I want us to think carefully as Christian leaders about our thinking in the present and the hypothesis that we're working with in the present how plausible that is. So think about your own scene, whether it's a building program or a youth group or your preaching or your outreach, your action in the present that embeds a hypothesis about the future. I want to say that because I don't think there's an option to say, just don't think about this stuff. Because that's, that's a hypothesis about the future. That there's nothing's changing, no biggie, nothing to see here. And that might be the right hypothesis. Maybe it's exactly weirdly linear from here on in and nothing changes. I think that's gotta be true. Yeah. Do you want a couple minutes for questions and then we're gonna, have a break. Are we going to break in 10:30 to 11? Is that right? Yep. And then we'll get into the actual details of the argument after that. But any questions or comments before we quickly recaffeinate? Oh, no. just because this is being recorded, I've got a personal aversion to the word thought leader, which isn't in principle a bad thing. Calvin's a thought leader. I think particularly, I do worry about the person that gives up local church ministry or local parachurch, you know, whatever, ministry to actual humans, just to hit the conference circuit. And I just think that's a inherently dangerous thing, for all sorts of reasons, including, just the how radical you can be in what you're selling and how little cost you bear for that. That you're not there in the community that you told that if you do it like this they will come, and then you did it like that and they didn't come, and you're not there facing up to say, oh, sorry they didn't come, I really need to repent for doing this. So I think a little thumb can be, who would this person repent to if they got it wrong? Same with economists, you know. Yes.
Do you have any thoughts about churches around you that have evening services that have folded? Like, why is that? Is it anything to do with the way that they responded to?
So that's the question, and we'll try to come back to that in the second section. But I reckon that's a really worthwhile thing. And if you think of that DVD analogy, like, what happened?
Yeah.
Because you could think, oh, stupid idiots down the road, they didn't know about electric guitars. But if you, in Albany, if you think, what happened to those other 7 DVD shops? Oh, they weren't clean enough. They weren't tidy enough. They didn't have enough range. Then that might explain why they died first. But what's happening to the DVD market is bigger than that. And so I think also what's true is that you, in a culture like ours, where at the moment there is that, it's difficult for Christian faith and Christian community. Often the average quality of Christian ministry goes up because that which remains has had to hold tenaciously to faithful practice and faithful teaching theology and stuff like that. Whereas somewhere like the Solomon Islands, which I've spent a bit of time in, it's almost like the opposite world to Australia. Well, yeah, if you had an XY graph, you've got Solomon's is kind of like 90% Christian, and has all the problems associated with Christian nominalism and that kind of thing, whereas we've kind of moved into an opposite zone where, the average quality of the discipleship in a local church, I think, is probably lifted as the quantity has, receded. Yeah. As an average. Oh, yes?
I was going to ask you about that. So, like, is secularization not a problem? Because, you know, the church started as quite a small minority of, you know, like a big world. Like, why should we not be worried?
Yeah. So you could, that's right. So one of the questions is, should this, and one of the narratives that I think we'll explore in the second session is like, is this like a big hit the red button panic, this is the worst thing ever, or is this just us getting back to a space that we occupied for a long time? And when you think about it, our founding document, aka the New Testament, envisaged something a bit more like what we're going into than like what we came out of. Yeah. Now, I also want to say not quite. I think there are some distinctions about what we're going into, but I do think that's broadly true, that if you think about... The Uber I bought here was with a really lovely Muslim guy, and we had a great chat, and it was this classic opposite world to the West. First question, hey, how are you going? What religion are you? Oh, I'm Muslim. What are you? I'm Christian. Oh, yeah, what, Muhammad said this. Oh, Jesus said this. And we're having this perfectly... civil, enthusiastic conversation about religion, both trying to evangelise each other, and then a big handshake at the end, God bless you, and then out of the car. Now, Islam and the Islamic founding documents are radically different from the New Testament, because Islam is telling you what to do when you seize power, and it can do it, and our many beautiful Muslim neighbours that do it show you that it can be done, but it doesn't envisage a situation where you're working out how to be a minority in a diaspora, in an alternative situation, whereas Christianity is the opposite, that every document is about how to be a minority diaspora where you haven't seized power, and then when you seize power, you're like, not quite prepared for this. Yeah. All right, we're going to pause, and then we'll be back at...